This is Kurt Benrud with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our show. We're reading from Thomas Hardy's final novel, Jude the Obscure, first published in 1895. Like much of Hardy's work, this book is quite critical of that era's British society. The novel's divided into six parts, each part into several short chapters. Each part will be read by a pair of readers who alternate chapters. This broadcast is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Continuing in Part 5 at Albrickham and elsewhere, we find ourselves early on in Chapter 5. The narrator has just got done describing the Great Wessex Agricultural Show. Lauren Armitage is reading Chapter 5 and the other odd chapters. Megan Mercerborn will be reading the even chapters.
It is the popular day. The shilling day, and of the fast-arriving excursion trains, two from different directions enter the two contiguous railway stations at almost the same minute. One, like several which have preceded it, comes from London. The other, by a cross line from Aldbrickham. And from the London train alights a couple. A short, rather bloated man with a globular stomach and small legs, resembling a top on two pegs, accompanied by a woman of rather fine figure and rather red face, dressed in black material and covered with beads from bonnet to skirt that make her glisten as if clad in chainmail. They cast their eyes around. The man was about to hire a fly, as some others had done, when the woman said, "Don't be in such a hurry, Cartlett. It isn't so very far to the show yard. Let us walk down the street into the place. Perhaps I can pick up a cheap bit of furniture or old china. It is years since I was here, never since I lived as a girl in Aldbrickham, and used to come across for a trip sometimes with my young man." "You can't carry home furniture by excursion train," said in a thick voice her husband, the landlord of the Three Horns, Lambeth, for they had both come down from the tavern in that excellent, densely populated gin-drinking neighborhood, which they had occupied ever since the advertisement in those words had attracted them thither. The configuration of the landlord showed that he, too, like his customers, was becoming affected by the liquors he retailed. "Then I'll get it sent if I see any worth having," said his wife. They sauntered on, but had barely entered the town when her attention was attracted by a young couple leading a child who'd come out from the second platform into which the train from Aldbrickham had steamed. They were walking just in front of the innkeepers.
"Sakes alive," said Arabella.
"What's that?" said Cartlett.
"Who do you think that couple is? Don't you recognize the man?"
"No."
"Not from the photos I have showed you?"
"Is it folly?"
"Yes, of course."
"Oh, well, I suppose he was inclined for a little sightseeing like the rest of us."
Cartlett's interest in Jude, whatever it might have been when Arabella was new to him, had plainly flagged since her charms and idiosyncrasies, her supernumerary hair coils, and her optional dimples were becoming as a tale that is told. Arabella so regulated her pace and her husband's as to keep just in the rear of the other three, which it was easy to do without notice in such a stream of pedestrians. Her answers to Cartlett's remarks were vague and slight, for the group in front interested her more than all the rest of the spectacle.
"They are rather fond of one another and of their child, seemingly," continued the publican.
"Their child? 'Tisn't their child," said Arabella, with a curious, sudden covetousness. "They haven't been married long enough for it to be theirs."
But although the smoldering maternal instinct was strong enough in her to lead her to quash her husband's conjecture, she was not disposed, on second thoughts, to be more candid than necessary. Mr. Cartlett had no other idea than that his wife's child by her first husband was with his grandparents at the Antipodes.
"Oh, I suppose not. She looks quite a girl."
"They are only lovers, or lately married, and have the child in charge, as anybody can see."
All continued to move ahead. The unwitting Sue and Jude, the couple in question, had determined to make this agricultural exhibition within 20 miles of their own town the occasion of a day's excursion, which should combine exercise and amusement with instruction, at small expense. Not regardful of themselves alone, they had taken care to bring Father Time, to try every means of making him kindle and laugh like other boys, though he was to some extent a hindrance to the delightfully unreserved intercourse in their pilgrimages which they had so much enjoyed. But they soon ceased to consider him an observer, and went along with that tender attention to each other which the shyest can scarcely disguise, and which these, among entire strangers, as they imagined, took less trouble to disguise than they might have done at home. Sue, in her new summer clothes, flexible and light as a bird, her little thumb stuck up by the stem of her white cotton sunshade, went along as if she hardly touched the ground, and as if a moderately strong puff of wind would float her over the hedge into the next field. Jude, in his light gray holiday suit, was really proud of her companionship, not more for her external attractiveness than for her sympathetic words and ways. That complete mutual understanding, in which every glance and movement was as effectual as speech for conveying intelligence between them, made them almost the two parts of a single whole. The pair, with their charge, passed through the turnstiles, Arabella and her husband not far behind them. When inside the enclosure, the publican's wife could see that the two ahead began to take trouble with the youngster, pointing out and explaining the many objects of interest, alive and dead, and a passing sadness would touch their faces at their every failure to disturb his indifferences. "How she sticks to him," said Arabella. "Oh, no, I fancy they are not married, or they wouldn't be so much to one another as that. I wonder." "But I thought you said he did marry her." "I heard he was going to, that's all. Going to make another attempt after putting it off once or twice. As far as they themselves are concerned, they are the only two in the show. I should be ashamed of making myself so silly if I were he. I don't see as how there's anything remarkable in their behavior. I should never have noticed their being in love if you hadn't said so." "You never see anything," she rejoined. Nevertheless, Cartlett's view of the lovers' or married pair's conduct was undoubtedly that of the general crowd, whose attention seemed to be in no way attracted by what Arabella's sharpened vision discerned. "He's charmed by her as if she were some fairy," continued Arabella. "See how he looks round at her and lets his eyes rest on her. I am inclined to think that she doesn't care for him quite so much as he does for her. She's not a particular warm-hearted creature, to my thinking, though she cares for him pretty middling much. As much as she's able to, and he could make her heart ache a bit if he liked to try, which he's too simple to do. There, now they are going across to the cart horse sheds. Come along."
"I don't want to see the cart horses. It is no business of ours to follow these two. If we have come to see the show, let us see it in our own way, as they do in theirs."
"Well, suppose we agree to meet somewhere in an hour's time, say at that refreshment tent over there, and go about independent. Then you can look at what you choose to, and so can I." Cartlett was not loath to agree to this, and they parted, he proceeding to the shed where malting processes were being exhibited, and Arabella in the direction taken by Jude and Sue. Before, however, she had regained their wake, a laughing face met her own, and she was confronted by Annie, the friend of her girlhood. Annie had burst out in hearty laughter at the mere fact of their chance encounter. "I am still living down there," she said as soon as she was composed. "I am soon going to be married, but my intended couldn't come up here today. But there's lots of us come by excursion, though I've lost the rest of them for the present. Have you met Jude and his young woman, or wife, or whatever she is? I saw him by now." "No, not a glimpse of him for years." "Well, they are close by here somewhere. Yes, there they are, by that gray horse." "Oh, that's his present young woman. Wife, did you say? Has he married again?" "I don't know. She's pretty, isn't she?" "Yes. Nothing to complain of or jump at. Nothing much to depend on, though. A slim, fidgety little thing like that. He's a nice-looking chap, too. "You ought to have stuck to an Arabella." "I don't know, but I ought," murmured she. Annie laughed. "That's you, Arabella, always wanting another man than your own." "Well, and what woman don't, I should like to know? As for that body with him, she don't know what love is. At least, what I call love. I can see in her face she don't. And perhaps, Abby dear, you don't know what she calls love? I'm sure I don't wish to." "Ah, they are making for the art department. I should like to see some pictures myself. Suppose we go that way. Why, if all Wessex isn't here, I verily believe. There's Dr. Vilbert. Haven't seen him for years, and he's not looking a day older than when I used to know him. How do you do, physician? I was just saying that you don't look a day older than when you knew me as a girl." "Simply the result of taking my own pills regular, ma'am. Only 2 and 3 pence a box, warranted efficacious by the government stamp. Now let me advise you to purchase the same immunity from the ravages of time by following my example. Only 2 and 3. The physician had produced a box from his waistcoat pocket, and Arabella was induced to make the purchase. "At the same time," continued he, when the pills were paid for, "you have the advantage of me, Mrs. Surely not Mrs. Fawley, once Miss Dawn of the vicinity of Maygreen?" "Yes, but Mrs. Cartlett now." "Ah, you lost him then. Promising young fellow. A pupil of mine, you know. I taught him the dead languages, and believe me, he soon knew nearly as much as I." "I lost him, but not as you think," said Arabella dryly. "The lawyers untied us. There he is. Look, alive and lusty, along with that young woman entering the art exhibition." "Ah, dear me. Fond of her, apparently." "They say they are cousins." "Cousinship is a great convenience to their feelings, I should say." "Yes, so her husband thought, no doubt, when he divorced her. Shall we look at the pictures, too?" The trio followed across the green and entered. Jude and Sue, with the child, unaware of the interest they were exciting, had gone up to a model at one end of the building, which they regarded with considerable attention for a long while before they went on. Arabella and her friends came to it in due course, and the inscription it bore was, "Model of Cardinal College, Christminster, by J. Fawley and S. F. M. Bridehead." "Admiring their own work," said Arabella. "How like Jude, always thinking of colleges and Christminster, instead of attending to his business." They glanced cursorily at the pictures, and proceeded to the bandstand. When they had stood a little while, listening to the music of the military performers, Jude, Sue, and the child came up on the other side. Arabella did not care if they should recognize her, but they were too deeply absorbed in their own lives, as translated into emotion by the military band, to perceive her under her beaded veil. She walked round the outside of the listening throng, passing behind the lovers, whose movements had an unexpected fascination for her today. Scrutinizing them narrowly from the rear, she noticed that Jude's hand sought Sue's as they stood, the two standing close together, so as to conceal, as they supposed, this tacit expression of their mutual responsiveness. "Silly fools, like two children," Arabella whispered to herself morosely as she rejoined her companions, with whom she preserved a preoccupied silence. Annie, meanwhile, had jokingly remarked to Vilbert on Arabella's hankering interest in her first husband. "Now," said the physician to Arabella apart, "do you want anything such as this, Mrs. Cartlett? It is not compounded out of my regular pharmacopoeia, but I am sometimes asked for such a thing." He produced a small phial of clear liquid. "A love filter, such as was used by the ancients, with great effect. I found it out by study of their writings, and have never known it to fail." "What is it made of?" asked Arabella curiously. "Well, a distillation of the juices of doves' hearts, otherwise pigeons, is one of the ingredients. It took nearly 100 hearts to produce that small bottle full." "How do you get pigeons enough?" "To tell a secret, I get a piece of rock salt, of which pigeons are inordinately fond, and place it in a dovecot on my roof. In a few hours, the birds come to it from all points of the compass, east, west, north, and south, and thus I secure as many as I require. You use the liquid by contriving that the desired man shall take about 10 drops of it in his drink. But remember, all this is told you because I gather from your questions that you mean to be a purchaser. You must keep faith with me. Very well. I don't mind a bottle to give some friend or other to try on her young man. She produced 5 shillings, the price asked, and slipped the phial in her capacious bosom. Saying presently that she was due at an appointment with her husband, she sauntered away towards the refreshment bar. Jude, his companion, and the child having gone on to the horticultural tent, where Arabella caught a glimpse of them standing before a group of roses in bloom. She waited a few minutes, observing them, and then proceeded to join her spouse with no very amiable sentiments. She found him seated on a stool by the bar, talking to one of the gaily dressed maids who had served him with spirits. "I should think you had enough of this business at home," Arabella remarked gloomily. "Surely you didn't come 50 miles from your own bar to stick in another. Come, take me round the show as other men do their wives. Damme, one would think you were a young bachelor with nobody to look after but yourself."
"But we agreed to meet here, and what could I do but wait?"
"Well, now, we have met. Come along," she returned, ready to quarrel with the sun for shining on her. And they left the tent together, this pot-bellied man and florid woman, in the antipathetic, recriminatory mood of the average husband and wife of Christendom. In the meantime, the more exceptional couple and the boy still lingered in the Pavilion of Flowers, an enchanted palace to their appreciative taste, Sue's unusually pale cheeks reflecting the pink of the tinted roses at which she gazed. For the gay sights, the air, the music, and the excitement of a day's outing with Jude had quickened her blood and made her eyes sparkle with vivacity. She adored roses, and what Arabella had witnessed was Sue detaining Jude almost against his will, while she learnt the names of this variety and that, and put her face within an inch of their blossoms to smell them. "I should like to push my face quite into them, the dears," she had said. "But I suppose it is against the rules to touch them, isn't it, Jude?" "Yes, you baby," said he, and then playfully gave her a little push so that her nose went among the petals. "The policeman will be down on us, and I shall say it was my husband's fault." Then she looked up at him and smiled in a way that told so much to Arabella. "Happy?" he murmured. She nodded. "Why? Because you have come to the Great Wessex Agricultural Show? Or because we have come? You are always trying to make me confess to all sorts of absurdities. Because I am improving my mind, of course, by seeing all these steam plows and threshing machines and chaff cutters and cows and pigs and sheep." Jude was quite content with a baffle from his ever-evasive companion. But when he had forgotten that he had put the question, and because he no longer wished for an answer, she went on. "I feel that we have returned to Greek joyousness, and have blinded ourselves to sickness and sorrow, and have forgotten what 25 centuries have taught the race since their time, as one of your Christminster luminaries says. There is one immediate shadow, however, only one." And she looked at the aged child, whom, though they had taken him to everything likely to attract a young intelligence, they had utterly failed to interest. He knew what they were saying and thinking. "I am very, very sorry, Father and Mother," he said, "but please don't mind. I can't help it. I should like the flowers very, very much if I didn't keep on thinking they'd all be withered in a few days."
Chapter 6. The unnoticed lives that the pair had hitherto led began, from the day of the suspended wedding onwards, to be observed and discussed by other persons than Arabella. The society of Spring Street and the neighbourhood generally did not understand, and probably could not have been made to understand, Sue and Jude's private minds, emotions, positions, and fears. The curious facts of the child coming to them unexpectedly, who called Jude father and Sue mother, and a hitch in the marriage ceremony, intended for quietness, to be performed at a registrar's office, together with rumors of the undefended cases in the law courts, bore only one translation to plain minds. Little time, for though he was formally turned into Jude, the apt nickname stuck to him, would come home from school in the evening, and repeat inquiries and remarks that had been made to him by the other boys, and cause Sue and Jude, when he heard them, a great deal of pain and sadness. The result was that shortly after the attempt at the registrar's, the pair went off, to London, it was believed, for several days, hiring somebody to look to the boy. When they came back, they let it be understood indirectly, and with total indifference and weariness of mien, that they were legally married at last. Sue, who had previously been called Mrs. Bridehead, now openly adopted the name of Mrs. Fawley. Her dull, cowed, and listless manner for days seemed to substantiate all this. But the mistake, as it was called, of their going away so secretly to do the business, kept up much the mystery of their lives, and they found that they made not such advances with their neighbors as they had expected to do thereby. A living mystery was not much less interesting than a dead scandal. The baker's lad and the grocer's boy, who at first had used to lift their hats gallantly to Sue when they came to execute their errands, in these days no longer took the trouble to render her that homage, and the neighboring artisans' wives looked straight along the pavement when they encountered her. Nobody molested them, it was true, but an oppressive atmosphere began to encircle their souls, particularly after their excursion to the show, as if that visit had brought some evil influence to bear on them, and their temperaments were precisely of a kind to suffer from this atmosphere, and to be indisposed to lighten it by vigorous and open statements. Their apparent attempt at reparation had come too late to be effective. The headstone and epitaph orders fell off, and 2 or 3 months later, when autumn came, Jude perceived that he would have to return to journey work again, a course all the more unfortunate just now, in that he had not as yet cleared off the debt he had unavoidably incurred in the payment of the law costs of the previous year. One evening he sat down to share the common meal with Sue and the child, as usual. "I'm thinking," he said to her, "that I'll hold on here no longer. The life suits us, certainly, but if we could get away to a place where we are unknown, we should be lighter-hearted and have a better chance. And so I'm afraid we must break it up here, however awkward for you, poor dear." Sue was always much offended at a picture of herself as the object of pity, and she saddened. "Well, I am not sorry," said she presently. "I'm much depressed by the way they look at me here, and you have been keeping on this house and furniture entirely for me and the boy. You don't want it yourself, and the expense is unnecessary. But whatever we do, wherever we go, you won't take him away from me, Jude dear. I could not let him go now. The cloud upon his young mind makes him so pathetic to me. I do hope to lift it some day. And he loves me, too. You won't take him away from me." "Certainly I won't, dear little girl. We'll get nice lodgings, wherever we go. I shall be moving about, probably getting a job here and a job there. I shall do something, too, of course, till—well, now I can't be useful in the lettering. It behooves me to turn my hand to something else." "Don't hurry about getting employed," he said regretfully. "I don't want you to do that. I wish you wouldn't, Sue. The boy and yourself are enough for you to attend to." There was a knock at the door, and Jude answered it. Sue could hear the conversation. "Is Mr. Fawley at home? Biles and Willis, the building contractors, sent me to know if you'll undertake the relettering of the Ten Commandments in the little church they've been restoring lately in the country near here." Jude reflected, and said he could undertake it. "It's not a very artistic job," continued the messenger. "The clergyman is a very old-fashioned chap, and he has refused to let anything more be done to the church than cleaning and repairing." "Excellent old man," said Sue to herself, who was sentimentally opposed to the horrors of over-restoration. The Ten Commandments are fixed to the east end, the messenger went on, and they want doing up with the rest of the wall there, since he won't have them carted off as old materials belonging to the contractor in the usual way of the trade. A bargain as to the terms was struck, and Jude came indoors. There, you see, he said cheerfully. One more job yet, at any rate, and you can help in it. At least you can try. We shall have all the church to ourselves as the rest of the work is finished. Next day, Jude went out to the church, which was only 2 miles off. He found that when the contractor's clerk had said was true. The tables of the Jewish law towered sternly over the utensils of Christian grace, as the chief ornament of the chancel end in the fine dry style of the last century. And as their framework was constructed of ornamental plaster, they could not be taken down for repair. A portion, crumbled by damp, required renewal, and when this had been done, and the whole cleansed, he began to renew the lettering. On the second morning, Sue came to see what assistance she could render, and also because they liked to be together. The silence and emptiness of the building gave her confidence, and, standing on a safe, low platform erected by Jude, which she was nevertheless timid at mounting, she began painting in the letters of the first table, while he set about mending a portion of the second. She was quite pleased at her powers. She had acquired them in the days she painted illuminated texts for the church fitting shop at Christminster. Nobody seemed likely to disturb them, and the pleasant twitter of birds and rustle of October leafage came in through an open window and mingled with their talk. They were not, however, to be left thus snug and peaceful for long. About 12:30 there came footsteps on the gravel without. The old vicar and his churchwarden entered, and, coming up to see what was being done, seemed surprised to discover that a young woman was assisting. They passed on into an aisle, at which time the door again opened, and another figure entered, a small one, that of little Time, who was crying. Sue had told him where he might find her between school hours, if he wished. She came down from her perch and said, "What's the matter, my dear?" "I couldn't stay to eat my dinner in school because they said—" He described how some boys had taunted him about his nominal mother, and Sue, grieved, expressed her indignation to Jude aloft. The child went into the churchyard, and Sue returned to her work. Meanwhile, the door had opened again, and there shuffled in, with a businesslike air, the white-aproned woman who cleaned the church. Sue recognized her as one who had friends in Spring Street, whom she visited. The church cleaner looked at Sue, gaped, and lifted her hands. She had evidently recognized Jude's companion as the latter, and recognized her. Next came two ladies, and after talking to the charwoman, they also moved forward, and as Sue stood searching upward, watched her hand tracing the letters, and critically regarded her person in relief against the white wall, till she grew so nervous that she trembled visibly. They went back to where the others were standing, talking in undertones, and one said, Sue could not hear which. "She's his wife, I suppose?" "Some say yes, some say no," was the reply from the charwoman. "Not? Then she ought to be, or somebody's, that's very clear. They've only been married a very few weeks, whether or no. A strange pair to be painting the two tables. I wonder Biles and Willis could think of such a thing as hiring those." The churchwarden supposed that Biles and Willis knew of nothing wrong, and then the other, who had been talking to the old woman, explained what she meant by calling them strange people. The probable drift of the subdued conversation which followed was made plain by the churchwarden breaking into an anecdote in a voice that everybody in the church could hear, though obviously suggested by the present situation. "Well, now, it's a curious thing, but my grandfather told me a strange tale of a most immoral case that happened at a painting of the commandments in a church out in Gaymead, which is quite within a walk of this one. In them days, commandments were mostly done in gilt letters on a black ground, and that's how they were out where I say, before the old church was rebuilded. It must have been somewhere about 100 years ago that them commandments wanted doing up, just as ours do here, and they had to get men from Aldbrickham to do them. Now, they wished to get the job finished by a particular Sunday, so the men had to work late Saturday night, against their will, for overtime was not paid then as 'tis now. There was no true religion in the country at that date, neither among parsons, clerks, nor people, and to keep the men up to their work, the vicar had to let them have plenty of drink during the afternoon. As evening drawed on, they sent for some more themselves, rum by all account. It got later and later, and they got more and more fuddled, till at last they went a-puttin' their rum-bottle and rummers upon the communion table, and drawed up a trestle or two, and sate round comfortable, and poured out again right hearty bumpers. No sooner had they tossed off their glasses than, so the story goes, they fell down senseless, one and all. How long they bode there, didn't know. But when they came to themselves, there was a terrible thunderstorm a-raging, and they seemed to see in the gloom a dark figure with very thin legs and a curious voot standing on the ladder and finishing their work. When it got daylight, they could see that the work was really finished and couldn't at all mind finishing it themselves. They went home, and the next thing they heard was that a great scandal had been caused in the church that Sunday morning, for when the people came and service began, all saw that the Ten Commandments was painted with the knots left out. Decent people wouldn't attend service there for a long time, and the bishop had to be sent for to reconsecrate the church. That's the tradition as I used to hear it as a child. You mustn't take it for what it is worth, but this case today has reminded me of it, as I say." The visitors gave one more glance, as if to see whether Jude and Sue had left the knots out likewise, and then severely left the church, even the old woman at last. Sue and Jude, who had not stopped working, sent back the child to school and remained without speaking, till, looking at her narrowly, he found she had been crying silently. "Never mind, comrade," he said. "I know what it is. I can't bear that they and everybody should think people wicked because they may have chosen to live their own way. It is really these opinions that make the best-intentioned people reckless and actually become immoral. Never be cast down. It was only a funny story. Ah, but we suggested it. I'm afraid I have done you mischief, Jude, instead of helping you by coming." To have suggested such a story was certainly not very exhilarating, in a serious view of their position. However, in a few minutes, Sue seemed to see that their position this morning had a ludicrous side, and wiping her eyes, she laughed. "It is droll, after all," she said, "that we two, of all people, with our queer history, should happen to be here painting the Ten Commandments, you a reprobate, and I, in my condition, oh dear!" And with her hand over her eyes, she laughed again silently and intermittently, till she was quite weak. "That's better," said Jude gaily. "Now we are right again, aren't we, little girl?" "Oh, but it is serious all the same," she sighed as she took up the brush and righted herself. "But do you see, they don't think we are married. They won't believe it. It is extraordinary." "I don't care whether they think so or not," said Jude. "I shan't take any more trouble to make them." They sat down to lunch, which they had brought with them not to hinder time, and having eaten it, were about to set to work anew, when a man entered the church, and Jude recognized in him the contractor Willis. He beckoned to Jude and spoke to him apart. "Here, I've just a complaint about this," he said, with rather breathless awkwardness. "I don't wish to go into the matter, as of course I didn't know what was going on, but I'm afraid I must ask you and her to leave off and let someone else finish this. It is best to avoid all unpleasantness. I'll pay you for the week, all the same." Jude was too independent to make any fuss, and the contractor paid him and left. Jude picked up his tools, and Sue cleansed her brush. Then their eyes met. "How could we be so simple as to suppose we might do this?" said she, dropping to her tragic note. "Of course we ought not. I ought not to have come. I had no idea that anybody was going to intrude into such a lonely place and see us," Jude returned. "Well, it can't be helped, dear. And of course I wouldn't wish to injure Willis's trade connection by staying." They sat down passively for a few minutes, proceeded out the church, and, overtaking the boy, pursued their thoughtful way to Aldbrickham. Fawley still had a pretty zeal in the cause of education, and, as was natural with his experiences, he was active in furthering equality of opportunity by any humble means open to him. He had joined an Artisans' Mutual Improvement Society, established in the town about the time of his arrival there. Its members, being young men of all creeds and denominations, included churchmen, Congregationalists, Baptists, Unitarians, Positivists, and others. Agnostics had scarcely been heard of at this time. Their one common wish, to enlarge their minds, forming a sufficiently close bond of union. The subscription was small, and the room homely, and Jude's activity, uncustomary acquirements, and above all, singular intuition on what to read and how to set about it, begotten of his years of struggle against malignant stars, had led to his being placed on the committee. A few evenings after his dismissal from the church repairs, and before he had obtained any more work to do, he went to attend a meeting of the aforesaid committee. It was late when he arrived, all the others had come, and as he entered they looked dubiously at him, and hardly uttered a word of greeting. He guessed that something bearing on himself had been either discussed or mooted. Some ordinary business was transacted, and it was disclosed that the number of subscriptions had shown a sudden falling off for that quarter. One member, a really well-meaning and upright man, began speaking in enigmas about certain possible causes, that it behooved them to look well into their constitution, for if the committee were not respected, and had not at least in their differences a common standard of conduct, they would bring the institution to the ground. Nothing further was said in Jude's presence, but he knew what this meant, and turning to the table, wrote a note, resigning his office there and then. Thus the supersensitive couple were more and more impelled to go away, and then bills were sent in, and the question arose, what could Jude do with his great-aunt's heavy old furniture if he left the town to travel he knew not whither? This, and the necessity of ready money, compelled him to decide on an auction, much as he would have preferred to keep the venerable goods. The day of the sale came on, and Sue, for the last time, cooked her own, the child's, and Jude's breakfast in the little house he had furnished. It chanced to be a wet day. Moreover, Sue was unwell, and not wishing to desert her poor Jude in such gloomy circumstances, for he was compelled to stay a while, she acted on the suggestion of the auctioneer's man, and ensconced herself in an upper room, which could be emptied of its effects, and so kept closed to the bidders. Here Jude discovered her, and with the child, and their few trunks, baskets, and bundles, and two chairs and a table that were not in the sale, the two sat in meditative talk. Footsteps began stamping up and down the bare stairs, the comers inspecting the goods, some of which were of so quaint and ancient a make as to acquire an adventitious value as art. Their door was tried once or twice, and to guard themselves against intrusion, Jude wrote "private" on a scrap of paper and stuck it upon the panel. They soon found that, instead of the furniture, their own personal histories and past conduct began to be discussed to an unexpected and intolerable extent by the intending bidders. It was not till now that they really discovered what a fool's paradise of supposed unrecognition they had been living in of late. Sue silently took her companion's hand, and with eyes on each other they heard these passing remarks, the quaint and mysterious personality of Father Time being a subject which formed a large ingredient in the hints and innuendos. At length the auction began in the room below, whence they could hear each familiar article knocked down, the highly prized ones cheaply, the unconsidered at an unexpected price. "People don't understand us," he sighed heavily. "I'm glad we've decided to go. The question is, where to? It ought to be London. There one can live as one chooses." "No, not London, dear. I know it well. We should be unhappy there." "Why? Can't you think?" "Because Arabella is there. That's the chief reason." "But in the country I shall always be uneasy, lest there should be some more of our late experience, and I don't care to lessen it by explaining, for one thing, all about the boy's history. To cut him off from his past, I have determined to keep silence. I'm sickened of ecclesiastical work now, and I shouldn't like to accept it if offered me." "You ought to have learnt classic. Gothic is barbaric art, after all. Pugin was wrong, and Wren was right. Remember the interior of Christminster Cathedral? Almost the first place in which we looked in each other's faces, under the picturesqueness Of those Norman details, one can see the grotesque childishness of uncouth people trying to imitate the vanished Roman forms, remembered by dim tradition only. Yes, you have half converted me to that view by what you have said before. But one can work and despise what one does. I must do something, if not church Gothic. I wish we could both follow an occupation in which personal circumstances don't count, she said, smiling up wistfully. I am as disqualified for teaching as you are for ecclesiastical art. You must fall back upon railway stations, bridges, theaters, music halls, hotels, everything that has no connection with conduct. I'm not skilled in those. I ought to take to bread baking. I grew up in the baking business with Aunt, you know. But even a baker must be conventional to get customers. Unless he keeps a cake and gingerbread stall at markets and fairs, where people are gloriously indifferent to everything except the quality of the goods. Their thoughts were diverted by the voice of the auctioneer. Now, this ancient oak settle, a unique example of old English furniture, worthy the attention of all collectors. That was my great-grandfather's, said Jude. I wish we could have kept the poor old thing. One by one the articles went, and the afternoon passed away. Jude and the other two were getting tired and hungry, but after the conversation they had heard they were shy of going out while the purchasers were in their line of retreat. However, the later lots drew on, and it became necessary to emerge into the rain soon to take on Sue's things to their temporary lodging. "Now the next lot, two pairs of pigeons, all alive and plump, a nice pie for somebody for next Sunday's dinner." The impending sale of these birds had been the most trying suspense of the whole afternoon. They were Sue's pets, and when it was found that they could not possibly be kept, more sadness was caused then by parting from all the furniture. Sue tried to think away her tears as she heard the trifling sum that her dears were deemed to be worth advanced by small stages to the price at which they were finally knocked down. The purchaser was a neighboring poulterer, and they were unquestionably doomed to die before the next market day. Noting her disassembled distress, Jude kissed her and said it was time to go and see if the lodgings were ready. He would go on with the boy and fetch her soon. When she was left alone, she waited patiently, but Jude did not come back. At last she started, the coast being clear, and on passing the poulterer's shop not far off, she saw her pigeons in a hamper by the door. An emotion at sight of them, assisted by the growing dusk of evening, caused her to act on impulse, and first looking around her quickly, she pulled out the peg which fastened down the cover and went on. The cover was lifted from within, and the pigeons flew away with a clatter that brought the chagrined poulterer cursing and swearing to the door. Sue reached the lodging trembling and found Jude and the boy making it comfortable for her. "Do the buyers pay before they bring things away?" she asked breathlessly. "Yes, I think. Why?" "Because then I've done a wicked thing," and she explained in bitter contrition. "I shall have to pay the poulterer for them if he doesn't catch them," said Jude. "But never mind. Don't fret about it, dear. It was so foolish of me. Oh, why should nature's law be mutual butchery?" "Is it so, mother?" asked the boy intently. "Yes," said Sue vehemently. "Well, they must take their chance now, poor things," said Jude. "As soon as the sale account is wound up and our bills are paid, we go." "Where do we go?" asked Time, in suspense. "We must sail under sealed orders, that nobody may trace us. We mustn't go to Alfredston, or to Melchester, or to Shaston, or to Christminster. Apart from those, we may go anywhere."
"Why mustn't we go there, father?"
"Because of a cloud that has gathered over us. Though we have wronged no man, corrupted no man, defrauded no man, though perhaps we have done which was right in our own eyes."
Chapter 7. From that week, Jude Fawley and Sue walked no more in the town of Aldbrickham. Whither they had gone, nobody knew, chiefly because nobody cared to know. Anyone sufficiently curious to trace the steps of such an obscure pair might have discovered without great trouble that they had taken advantage of his adaptive craftsmanship to enter on a shifting, almost nomadic life, which was not without its pleasantness for a time. Wherever Jude heard of free stonework to be done, thither he went, choosing by preference places remote from his old haunts and sues. He labored at a job, long or briefly, till it was finished, and then moved on. 2 whole years and a half passed thus. Sometimes he might have been found shaping the mullions of a country mansion, sometimes setting the parapet of a town hall, sometimes ashlaring a hotel at Sandbourne, sometimes a museum at Casterbridge, and sometimes as far down as Exonbury, sometimes at Stoke Barehills. Later still, he was at Kennetbridge, a thriving town not more than a dozen miles south of Marygreen, this being his nearest approach to the village where he was known. For he had a sensitive dread of being questioned as to his life and fortunes by those who had been acquainted with him during his ardent young manhood of study and promise, and his brief and unhappy married life at that time. At some of these places he would be detained for months, at others only a few weeks. His curious and sudden antipathy to ecclesiastical work, both episcopal and nonconformist, which had risen in him when suffering under a smarting sense of misconception, remained with him in cold blood, less from any fear of renewed censure than from an ultra-conscientiousness, which would not allow him to seek a living out of those who would disapprove of his ways. Also, too, from a sense of inconsistency between his former dogmas and his present practice, hardly a shred of the beliefs with which he had first gone up to Christminster now remaining with him. He was mentally approaching the position which Sue had occupied when he first met her. On a Saturday evening in May, nearly 3 years after Arabella's recognition of Sue and himself at the agricultural show, some of those who there encountered each other met again. It was the spring fair at Kennetbridge, and though this ancient trade meeting had much dwindled from its dimension of former times, the long straight street of the borough presented a lively scene about midday. At this hour, a light trap, among other vehicles, was driven into the town by the north road, and up to the door of a temperance inn. There alighted two women, one the driver, an ordinary country person, the other a finely built figure, in the deep mourning of a widow. A somber suit of pronounced cut caused her to appear a little out of place in the medley and bustle of a provincial fair. "I will just find out where it is, Annie," said the widow lady to her companion, when the horse and cart had been taken by a man who came forward, "and then I'll come back and meet you here, and we'll go in and have something to eat and drink. I begin to feel quite a sinking." "With all my heart," said the other, "though I would sooner have put up at the Checkers or the Jack. You can't get much at these temperance houses." "Now don't you give way to gluttonous desires, my child," said the woman in weeds reprovingly. "This is the proper place. Very well. We'll meet in half an hour, unless you come with me to find out where the site of the new chapel is." "I don't care to. You can tell me." The companions then went their several ways, the one in crape, following firmly along with a mien of disconnection from her miscellaneous surroundings. Making inquiries, she came to a hoarding, within which were excavations denoting the foundations of a building, and on the boards without one or two large posters announcing that the foundation stone of the chapel about to be erected would be laid that afternoon at 3 o'clock by a London preacher of great popularity among his body. Having ascertained thus, the immensely weeded widow retraced her steps, and gave herself leisure to observe the movements of the fair. By and by, her attention was arrested by a little stall of cakes and gingerbreads, standing between the more pretentious erections of trestles and canvas. It was covered with an immaculate cloth, and tended by a young woman, apparently unused to the business, she being accompanied by a boy with an octogenarian face, who assisted her. "Upon my senses," murmured the widow to herself, "his wife Sue, if she is so." She drew nearer to the stall. "How do you do, Mrs. Fawley?" she said blandly. Sue changed color and recognized Arabella through the crape veil. "How are you, Mrs. Cartlett?" she said stiffly, and then, perceiving Arabella's garb, her voice grew sympathetic in spite of herself. "What? You have lost—" "My poor husband, yes. He died suddenly, 6 weeks ago, leaving me none too well off, though he was a kind husband to me. But whatever profit there is in public housekeeping goes to them that brew the liquors, and not to them that retail 'em. And you, my little old man, you don't know me, I expect. Yes, I do. You be the woman I thought were my mother for a bit, till I found you wasn't, replied Father Time, who had learned to use the Wessex tongue quite naturally by now. All right, never mind. I am a friend. Jewy, said Sue suddenly, go down to the station platform with this tray. There's another train coming in, I think. When he was gone, Arabella continued. He'll never be a beauty, will he, poor chap? Does he know I am his mother, really? No. He thinks there is some mystery about his parentage, that's all. Jude is going to tell him when he is a little older. But how do you come to be doing this? I am surprised. It is only a temporary occupation, a fancy of ours while we are in a difficulty. Then you are living with him still? Yes. Married? Of course. Any children? Two. And another coming soon, I see. Sue writhed under the hard and direct questioning, and her tender little mouth began to quiver. Lord, I mean, goodness gracious, what is there to cry about? Some folks would be proud enough. It's not that I am ashamed, not as you think, but it seems such a terribly tragic thing to bring beings into the world, so presumptuous, that I question my right to do it sometimes. Take it easy, my dear. But you don't tell me why you do such a thing as this. Jude used to be a proud sort of a chap, above any business almost, leave alone keeping a standing. Perhaps my husband has altered a little since then. I am sure he is not proud now. And Sue's lips quivered again. I am doing this because he caught a chill early in the year while putting up some stonework of a music hall at Quartershot, which he had to do in the rain, the work having to be executed by a fixed day. He is better than he was, but it has been a long, weary time. We have had an old widow friend with us to help us through it, but she's leaving soon. Well, I am respectable, too, thank God, and of a serious way of thinking since my loss. Why did you choose to sell gingerbreads? That's a pure accident. He was brought up to the baking business, and it occurred to him to try his hand at these, which he can make without coming out of doors. We call them Christminster cakes. They are a great success. I never saw any like 'em. Why, they are windows and towers and pinnacles. And upon my word, they are very nice. She had helped herself and was unceremoniously munching one of the cakes. Yes, they're reminiscences of the Christminster colleges. Traceried windows and cloisters, you see. It was a whim of his to do them in pastry. Still harping on Christminster, even in his cakes, laughed Arabella. Just like Jude. A ruling passion. What a queer fellow he is, and always will be. Sue sighed, and she looked her distress at hearing him criticized. Don't you think he is? Come now, you do, though you are so fond of him. Of course, Christminster is a sort of fixed vision with him, which I suppose he'll never be cured of believing in. He still thinks it a great center of high and fearless thought instead of what it is, a nest of commonplace schoolmasters whose characteristic is timid obsequiousness to tradition. Arabella was quizzing Sue with more regard of how she was speaking than of what she was saying. How odd to hear a woman selling cakes talk like that, she said. Why don't you go back to school-keeping? She shook her head. They won't have me. Because of the divorce, I suppose? That and other things. And there is no reason to wish it. We gave up all ambition, and were never so happy in our lives till his illness came. Where are you now living? I don't care to say. Here in Kennetbridge? Sue's manner showed Arabella that her random guess was right. Here comes the boy back again, continued Arabella. My boy and Jude's. Sue's eyes darted a spark. You needn't throw that in my face, she cried. Very well, though I half feel as if I should like to have him with me. But, Lord, I don't want to take him from me. Ever I should sin to speak so profane, though I should think you must have enough of your own. He's in very good hands, that I know, and I am not the woman to find fault with what the Lord has ordained. I've reached a more resigned frame of mind. Indeed, I wish I had been able to do so. You should try, replied the widow, from the serene heights of a soul conscious not only of spiritual but of social superiority. I make no boast of my awakening, but I'm not what I was. After Cartlett's death, I was passing the chapel in the street next hours and went into it for shelter from a shower of rain. I felt a need of some sort of support under my loss, and as 'twas righter than gin, I took to going there regular and found it a great comfort. But I've left London now, you know, and at present I am living at Alfredston with my friend Annie, to be near my old country. I'm not come here to the fair today. There's to be the foundation stone of a new chapel laid this afternoon by a popular London preacher, and I drove over with Annie. Now I must go back to meet her. Then Arabella wished Sue goodbye and went on.
Chapter 8. In the afternoon, Sue and the other people bustling about Kennetbridge Fair could hear singing inside the placarded hoarding farther down the street. Those who peeped through the opening saw a crowd of persons in broadcloth, with hymn books in their hands, standing round the excavations for the new chapel walls. Arabella Cartlett and her weeds stood among them. She had a clear, powerful voice, which could be distinctly heard with the rest, rising and falling to the tune, her inflated bosom being also seen doing likewise. It was 2 hours later on the same day that Annie and Mrs. Cartlett, having had tea at the Temperance Hotel, started on their return journey across the high and open country which stretches between Kennetbridge and Alfredston. Arabella was in a thoughtful mood, but her thoughts were not of the new chapel, as Annie at first surmised. "No, it's something else," at last said Arabella sullenly. "I came here today never thinking of anybody but poor Cartlett, or of anything but spreading the gospel by means of this new tabernacle they've begun this afternoon. But something has happened to turn my mind another way quite. Annie, I've heard of Unagin, and I've seen her." "Who?" "I've heard of Jude, and I've seen his wife, and ever since, do what I will, and though I sung the hymns with all my strength, I have not been able to help thinking about him, which I've no right to do as a chapel member. Can't you fix your mind upon what was said by the London preacher today, and try to get rid of your wandering fancies that way?" "I do, but my wicked heart will ramble off in spite of myself." "Well, I know what it is to have a wanton mind of my own, too. If you only knew what I do dream sometimes o' nights, quite against my wishes, you'd say I had my struggles." Annie, too, had grown rather serious of late, her lover having jilted her. "What shall I do about it?" urged Arabella morbidly. "You could take a lock of your late husband's hair and have it made into a mourning brooch and look at it every hour of the day." "I haven't a morsel, and if I had, 'twould be no good. After all that's said about the comforts of this religion, I wish I had Jude's back again." "You must fight valiant against the feeling, since he's another's, and I've heard that another good thing for it, when it afflicts voluptuous widows, is to go to your husband's grave in the dusk of evening and stand a long while bowed down." "Pooh! I know as well as you what I should do, only I don't do it."
Well, that's it for this program of readings from Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure. Check back with us at the same time next week. We'll read another episode. Meanwhile, thanks from me. Thanks from today's readers. Glad to have you tuning in. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Have a good day.
Thank you.